And
Embarrassment of embarrassments is that I, because Phyllis was on question of five on the biblical concept of shalom. And today I'm going to do a little bit of work, and then I'm going to ask you to work very hard. I'm going to talk about Walter Brueggemann's ideas about shalom and how he directs them to the healthcare profession. And then, because I'm so intimately involved with my leg and the healthcare profession, and because there have been so many, and because I've run into so many healthcare professionals here, using that as an example. But it is just an example of how he approaches the idea of shalom that is slightly different from Lofink's, which we talked about yesterday. Let me just remind you that Lofink took a radical economic approach to shalom. He wrote this book, Option for the Poor, which suggests that God has an option, or the liberation theology term is preferential option for the poor. That God is concerned with removing the barriers to their shalom, somehow convinced that once the barriers, that is the upper level of the economic strata and the power strata, which has hoarded the resources and kept them from the poor, is removed, that balance will be restored. Brueggemann, unlike Lofink, takes a radically theological approach. He is much more comfortable with an American type of personal piety that focuses in on personal responsibility and personal sin. It is that, that to some extent it separates one's spirituality from one's condition in life. And I have some problems with that, but I also am American enough to understand it and respect that personal piety. I think that's an important, personal piety is an important part of our religious life. And we do live in a world that is different from the Israelite life, which was very, very corporate. Personal sin in this scheme is the primary roadblock to shalom, but he does acknowledge that the personal sin has broad consequences when the personal sin belongs to those who have more authority or more power within the structure. The fact that all human beings rebel against their creator allows Brueggemann to equate all sin against, or all sins against the creation. And this is where I begin to have a real problem with Walt Brueggemann, in that he, I think that there's a fundamental difference between my sin, when it's a sin that I choose to be in, and my sin when it's because it's the lesser, in my opinion, the lesser of two evils, because someone else has blocked the road for me to fulfillment. Or to put it the other way, if I choose to stay in a position of sin at a $40,000 a year job or an $80,000 a year job, I'm dreaming now. About possibilities of income in my profession. But if I choose those oppressions, the deadlines, someone else setting my schedule for me, telling me that I have to be at work and therefore can't see my family the way I like to, that's different from the person who cannot see his or her family because if they don't work, they won't eat. The person who makes more than enough money to live in this culture and continues to accumulate things and thereby oppresses one's own self by choice is, to me, fundamentally different than the person who has no choice because of lack of education, because lack of opportunities within the system, who has to be away from family, or makes the terrible choice of robbing or murdering, of violating the laws, the covenant of the society, and winds up incarcerated or in exile, self-imposed exile because of the need to, the wish to escape prosecution. I think those are fundamentally different. And Brueggemann says that all oppression is oppression, no matter where it comes from and what the degree. And when he talks about it as sin, I can agree with that theologically, but as soon as I move practically to the way that looks, I begin to argue with him. Lofink's preference for the poor in 1976, when Brueggemann wrote Living Toward a Vision, was not a part of his scheme. It may be now. He's had 14 years to think about it, and liberation theology has made more of an impact than many people believed it would in the early 70s, late 60s and early 70s. I'm not sure if Brueggemann moves, how much Brueggemann has moved in that direction since then. The work of his that I know doesn't deal with that topic. The later work that I know doesn't deal with this kind of a topic so directly. But for Brueggemann, sin holds us all in a bond, and or in a bind, and we are all both sinners and forgiven. To use an old Lutheran expression, we are also all oppressed and all oppressors by the way the system has been put together, the way we have put the system together. Am I making sense as I race through Brueggemann here of the differences that I see between Brueggemann and Lofink? Any questions or comments about distinctions or similarities? Well, he takes as his chief example in the latter part of his book the healthcare delivery system in the United States. And he hearkens back, as the Old Testament does, to sort of a mythological time. Maybe a time that existed for the American Caucasian middle class, but didn't ever exist for the whole country. In much the same way that the ideal presented in the Hebrew Bible, where everyone was faithful to Yahweh, probably never really existed, but it looks good when you present the scheme. And when you write the history, the theological history, you do have to streamline it and drive forward your theological point. And after all, the Old Testament is a theological book rather than a historical collection of books. But when Brueggemann describes this on page 176, he talks about then and he talks about now. And then we were in a time of limited resources, limited economic resources, and because of that, all had access to the social benefits. No one could get. There are some things that no one could get, and what was around, almost everyone could get.
When was then?
Then, I think, is a sort of mythological then. He's talking about the old days of healthcare before the growth of the healthcare industry in the United States.
Okay.
But the truth of it is that there was a time when healthcare was church provided. They really were extensions of the church and other religious organizations, where they weren't driven by profit. What they tried to do was stay out of debt, but they.
So is he thinking maybe turn of the century or early?
He doesn't list the time. He just says then.
He just says then.
Yeah. But the assumption is that everyone had, because the resources were limited, everyone had access. The second point about then is that conventional wisdom and common sense led the way. And so what everybody knew enough to get by. Everybody knew enough to get what they needed out of the healthcare system. And everyone knew enough of the truth to be free. And because existence in the old days was derived from the community, we all belonged, he says. And Brueggemann is, let me just back up a step. Brueggemann is clear in the beginning of his book that his we is the American middle class, and that he's aware of his limitation in that sense. When he talks about now, he says that money, knowledge, and access are no longer shared, but controlled by a few. And the natural network has collapsed. Healthcare is no longer a natural function of the social life, and the delivery system is no longer a natural interaction among neighbors. The health establishment asks the questions, who can pay, who knows how, and who belongs. And having been to the hospital for one major deal and one relatively minor deal twice in the last 18 months, I'm really struck by this. Even the hospital that I like so much in my community, which is a tremendous influence on our community, and I think a very progressive hospital in terms of what it does for folks, ask you a whole lot of questions before they let you in the door. They remain a part of our trauma network in Chicago and the Chicago area, but the trauma network has dropped from about 12 to, I'm not sure if it's 4 or 6 hospitals. So you can, in Chicago now, you can be shot or hit by a car on the corner in front of a hospital and be driven across town because some hospitals with all of the resources to fly a kidney from Alaska or a liver from Alaska to Chicago for a baby or a child from Southern California or Florida won't take care of someone hurt on its doorstep. That's the way the healthcare system doesn't work. You walk in and you flash your card, and then they'll start to talk to you. I think the first question is name, and the second question is what's wrong, and the third question is how you're going to pay for it. At least it's not 3-2-1 yet. Brueggemann says that this is not an economic crisis, but a crisis of categories. He says the question is, how do we want to perceive our reality? He says we need to refocus our lenses as we look at the world. Like the hunger crisis, where there is food rotting all over this country, food being dumped in many parts of the world, while other parts of the world can't get at it. Some of the situations we know, people are more than willing to give up the food, give up the profit, if we could get it there. And even when we get it there, there are other people at the other end who, for political purposes, won't let it go.
Doing the same thing in education. We're categorizing people out of health that they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The healthcare system is only an example that I'm using because Brueggemann uses it. Any place where people come to power and have the ability to make decisions for everyone, we have this potential for a crisis where it gets hoarded, where it gets not distributed, the wealth gets not distributed, it's maintained for a select group. It's always been the case in education in this country.
And I'm thinking special education right now, where we're changing laws because of money and power at the government level, and redefining who qualifies, and there's a whole group that won't qualify anymore, and they tend to not have the advocates that can get them the help, and that's the same thing in there.
Well, if these questions can be asked in your circle of the world, increasing concentric circles, then you have the potential for the problem. Who can pay? Who knows how? And who belongs? If you can ask those questions, or if those questions are asked anywhere in your profession, then you have the potential for this kind of a crisis in your circle of the world. He says, do we have to ask ourselves, do we want to continue to consider ourselves an urban technological society? Do we want to say that you need to be near a major urban center to get the best of everything in this country? And then he uses Paul Tournier and his distinction of personal medicine versus technical medicine. Just checking my spelling. He says that personal medicine is the mysterious healing interaction that takes place when people take one another seriously, and that technical medicine is the approach to medicine that emphasizes science, machines, and institutions. He does not, and I want to make this very clear, he does not, nor do I, disparage technical medicine. It's a very important part of our lives. But what has happened is technical medicine has taken over all of medicine, so that it's rare, it really is rare these days, to find a surgeon with a good bedside manner. When our daughter was born, thank God I wasn't here, I wasn't there. She needed surgery before she was, she had surgery when she was 3 days old, because they discovered that her digestive tract wasn't working. They had to go in and repair it. And so my wife lay in bed, her husband halfway around the world. The baby was 3 weeks early. I'm not a total heel. I was supposed to be back for delivery. But Carrie, in her own fashion, did it in her own time and came 3 weeks early. Having learned that she had a retarded baby, And the baby needed surgery or the baby would die. And the doctor came and stood at the door of the room to describe the surgery and handed the form for informed consent. That was the best he could do, I'm sure. And it was the best that his education and dehumanization in the system would allow him to care for this situation. His job was to go in and fix that duodenum so it would open up and pass the food through. But it is rare in this system to find a surgeon with a good manner with people. Areas, family medicine, find a family doctor these days. It's a hard thing to do because we've so specialized, not only in the classic specializations, but people who only do. My back was out to try to find a second opinion for my back, so that my insurance would pay 100% of the surgical fees rather than 80%. I called three or four orthopedic surgeons, and I only do knees and shoulders. My partner who does backs is out of the state right now. He won't be back until such and such. Yeah, I mean, that orthopedic surgery, right? You fix the bones. How different can they be? Well, within a practice, there's one guy who does backs, one guy who does knees, and
there's some of them that don't do the whole back.
Yeah.
I had back surgery, and as on my seventh vertebrae up, and he says, I don't do that.
Don't work that high.
I'm a nurse. But of course, naturally, he charged me money too.
So we've become incredibly specialized, so that the person not only thinks about his or her specialty, that part of the body that he knows or she knows everything about, but there's no connection between the knee or the back or the shoulder, let alone the psyche, and that's we've established. As if I had anything to do with it, right? They have established through clinical studies that one's attitude toward an illness makes an incredible difference in how quickly or if you recover. And if the doctor isn't part of that, then it makes for a problem with the recovery. It slows the recovery or blocks the recovery.
Now, isn't there quite a few family practice centers now? There's one where I, well, there's two where I live. There's a family practice physician, family practice center. And I know the family practice center serves the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
But 99 of the doctors are still in, finishing their medical training.
Yeah. My bet is that they're young doctors who are working for somebody else, and that if you go in, you don't see Doc Jones. You see whoever is there that day. And when I did my tendon, I said, Jack Robbins is my orthopedic surgeon, call him. And that made a difference to me. I mean, I'm sure that the resident who saw me in the emergency room was competent. I mean, he did exactly what Robbins did, only on a temporary basis. And Robbins did this cast the next day. And he sees Jack Robbins every day. But when he came back with having talked to Robbins on the phone, I felt a lot better. And I knew that I believed that we were taking the right route with more confidence. And that makes a difference, that I'm treated as a human being, and not as a leg, not as a damaged leg. Any other questions or comments? The point that I'm trying to make from Brueggemann is that we have, in the healthcare system, isolated it in such a way that the real purpose of shalom, their idea of shalom, is to fix body parts and to make money. Mm-hmm. It is a healthcare delivery system today. That's not to say that there aren't people who are there in large numbers who want to help people, but in many ways they're prevented from doing so. One area that is...
They need the specialized help, right? But they need more of a specialized help than just a regular going seeing the doctor.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that the fact that we do need this technological advance. Mm-hmm. The question is what is the price that we're paying for it?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean when we can, because it's a dramatic case, fly a kidney from the West Coast and a child from the Southeast to a hospital in Chicago and transplant the liver or the kidney or the heart, and we let somebody die on the doorstep because we're not part of the trauma network anymore? Or we're not sure that he can pay or she can pay.
Does the bigness have something to do with that? The largeness of the city and the numbers of people that you become so detached?
I think that has something to do with it. I think the network, that healthcare has become the right of those who can pay for it rather than the gift of healing to the whole community.
Because I see that different. I'm in a community of 50,000, and I see that as very different. What you're saying is something I hear about in bigger cities, but in this community I don't.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if it's almost a mentality that starts happening in the closeness and the as things yeah. start multiplying and problems start getting
yeah.
bigger and more.
I don't think they're... Well, when you get bigger, you make policies.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Yeah. If it's just a nature of the beast.
I think that's Brueggemann's argument, is that it's an institution rather than a person-to-person process now. We don't, in many cases, we don't know who we're going to see when we walk in the door.
And so in our modern circle, the word that grows out, depersonalized.
Mm-hmm. It does depersonalize. The whole HMO concept is theoretically a great one, but because it should provide care to more people, but the profit element has made it such that what we tend to do in the HMOs is get the doctors fresh out of medical school, and that's where they get their experience, and then they get so overworked that they leave. And the other part of that is the nurses. I mean, the incredible turnover of nurses because the system is tiered. I think women were much more willing 20 years ago to work for a man, which was usually the case in the medical profession, if they had a relationship, and just a human relationship. Certainly the women's movement has opened up tons of possibilities, so that there are far more women who are physicians, that they realize that if you want to be in healthcare, you can be a doctor, you don't have to be a nurse, you don't have to be a physical therapist. If you want to do that, that's fine, but there are other options for women in healthcare. But few nurses have relationships with the doctors anymore. The doctors are the ones who come through and write something down and bark an order, and they don't have time or make time to stop and say, hello, how are you? So these women, and in some cases men, are working incredible hours, not using all of their personal resources, being underpaid as far as the system goes, making a third or a fourth of what the doctors are making, when in fact, the nurses are doing most of the work.
They're also asked to cover up major errors on the part of doctors.
Mm-hmm. So they're in a place in this system where we've got this picture that we saw of the top taking more than its share for what it's doing. Any doctors here, please defend yourselves. But every system where the questions can be asked, who can pay, what do you know, or who knows how to do it, and who belongs, this is what's going to happen. It's not just with medicine. It certainly happens in education, certainly in higher education, where we're moving into a situation again where only the children of the wealthy are going to be able to go to college. Where it used to cost something like 15% of a family's annual income to send a child to college, it's now back in the neighborhood of 25 to 30%. Money Magazine predicted one of their issues last month that it's going to cost $300,000 in 18 years to send a kid to an Ivy League school. I mean, what can you learn there that's worth $300,000? My God, put the money in a CD and give it to the kid 4 years later. Yeah. So that any system sets that up.
Yeah, I was going to say, so what can we do to change this system?
See, that's where I said, I'm not going to work hard today. Okay. You're going to work hard today. Let me just end with this part with some quotations from Brueggemann to talk about the action of God being an elimination of qualifications of at least two of these questions of who knows and who belongs, and I guess possibly by inference then who can pay. He says that both the action of God in the Exodus which we talked about yesterday but didn't read, and the actions of God in the ministry of Jesus, eliminate the question of qualification. It's not a matter of competence anymore in, when we share in the covenant of God and then in the new covenant of Jesus Christ. It's a question of what God has done to include people. And listen to these, the way he points these out. There are about eight of them. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear. And these are people who live outside of the center in ancient Israel. They're not able to provide for themselves, and so they're excluded from the community. The blind, the lame, the lepers, what a ministry to these people that you're not even supposed to be around. And Jesus steps into their lives and says, "You are clean. Go see the priest." You know, the priest must have been horrified when these people came to be declared clean, because he knew that this couldn't happen. You know, these people can't come near the temple. They can't come near me. If they get near me, then I'm outside. That's from Luke 7, when they ask for evidence that the reign of God has come. Maybe some suggestions as to how we can make the changes. Listen to these other illustrations that Luke and Matthew. Almost all of these are from Luke. And you've probably heard before that Luke is the gospel that is concerned with both healing and with the poor. And that's why Luke is called the physician, because there are so many, proportionally so many more healings in Luke than the other gospels, or they're emphasized in Luke in a way that they're not in the other gospels. And the poor have a special place in Luke. I mean, the Beatitudes. In Matthew, it says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Luke says, "Blessed are the poor." But both sets of Beatitudes begin with the poor. Lofink wants you to remember. But what can we do? Well, when you throw a party, according to Luke 14, you know, go out in the highways and the byways and force them to come in. All the riffraff are included in the banquet. Not just those who can repay you, not just those who will have you over for a barbecue next week, but those who genuinely need to eat. Let's feed them, because they're not qualified except by the fact that they're part of God's creation. And that's the only qualification needed. The latecomers in Matthew 20, 1 through 16. Some people come in the beginning of the day and they work all day. They agree on a wage. And some people come later in the day. And some people come at lunch hour. Some people come in the afternoon. And some people come an hour before quitting time. And everybody gets paid the same. And Jesus says in Matthew 20, that's all right. That's how God is. That's what God intends. In Luke 7, the extravagant, careless women are more welcome than the careful managers. In Luke 14, well, we can heal people on the Sabbath. Yes, it's important to have a day of rest, but if someone needs rest from 20 years of affliction or 7 years of affliction, we can do it. As someone who showed us a great act of mercy on our way out here said in the Pacific Northwest, if someone's in a world of hurt, you help them. You don't wait till the time is right. That a Samaritan turns out to be the brother And this, for me, having grown up in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is an incredible statement, and I think anybody who's still in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and hears this should tremble when you read the parable, the story of the Good Samaritan. That the one who understands how to reinstitute shalom is the one who has been excluded on the basis of the understanding of who God is. On the basis of understanding of who God is and how to worship God and where to worship God, the Samaritans had been outcast. But if the story of the Good Samaritan tells us anything, it's how we reinstitute, how we create shalom. To explain why I am so hard on the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, other than it having been the church in which I was reared, in the midst of the blow-up that started in 69 and culminated in 74 with the creation of Seminex from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, many of my classmates at Concordia and Fort Wayne were literally disowned by their fathers and their stepfathers, and not stepfathers, fathers-in-law. They just, because they went to Seminex, they no longer existed. There's a story of two brothers, one who was a vice president for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and his brother who was a professor, went with Seminex, and they did not speak to one another, and as far as I know, have not spoken to one another for those 15 years. I don't know that, I just assume that, since it was the shattering was so bitter there. One of my pastors from Saginaw, Michigan, where I was still a member in those days, was confused by this mess. And this was a managerial type congregation that just really wanted to be as faithful as they could, as any congregation does. Took one of the pastors and two of the lay leaders to St. Louis. Got to St. Louis, called the LCMS office, made an appointment, and saw this vice president of the LCMS. Just showed up and called him and made an appointment for either later in the day or the next day. And this guy hadn't talked to his brother for 2 years on the basis of a theological difference. So a stranger can walk in, but your brother can't. And I think that's why I think about this, the Good Samaritan story. Jews who read the Bible a little differently, not being able to be Jews in Hellenistic Palestine. And Brueggemann's last example here is that the disqualified brother, the prodigal son, the one who has spent his inheritance but repented, gets the party. And talk about being disqualified or unqualified. Dad, I know you're going to die someday and you're going to leave me some money. How about giving me my part now? I go off and I spend it in a profligate way, and I come back and my dad throws me a party. He's so happy that I'm home. Deserving of the party? Please. On the other side of that, Brueggemann looks at Luke 6 and Mark 3 and Luke 19 to describe those who are the guardians of privilege and how they responded to Jesus opening up the world of God to those who were unqualified. And he says that they were filled with fury in Luke 6. They are hard-hearted in Mark 3:5, and they seek to eliminate him. And well, that's Luke 19, but we don't need much evidence for that, do we? We know how the story turns out. Well, the questions, you've heard them already. How much time do we have left? How can I talk so much? are these, and I'm going to ask you for your, well, let's just stay comfortable this time, and rather than forcing you into groups, I'll do what one of my colleagues says, in groups of 3, 2, or 1, depending on your comfort level and how much you want to move, consider these questions. In my profession or in my area of the world, where do we ask these questions? Who can pay? Who knows how to do it? And who belongs? And what can I do about it? Where does it have to be that way? Why does it have to be that way? And if it doesn't have to be that way, what can I change about it? That's one. Let's just take 5 minutes to either turn and talk with folk or sit and think about it yourself. But in groups of 3, 2, or 1, find someone you feel comfortable with, or if it's only yourself, that's fine. But this is the time to reflect on the week and what we've been doing here in the morning, and ask the question, who has access in my profession? Who has access to the plenty that I enjoy, and why is it that way, and does it need to be that way? Who can pay, who knows how, and who belongs? I want you to talk about your professions right now. We'll talk about the church in the next round, okay? Unless your profession happens to be the church. Let me seize your attention and invite you to continue these conversations afterwards. I've got a couple more places I want you to talk about before we go, and I want to hear back from you as to what kinds of things you heard from one another. We'll spend just a couple minutes kind of checking in and see how similar it sounded in different places. Anything really striking? Any new revelations for anyone about his or her profession, or new challenges? You guys did all that great talking.
Well, Diane was talking about public education, children who are retarded or
learning
disabilities. How, in her experience, the state money is being restricted more and more, so that more and more those who can pay, those who know how to get the money, those who have some way of belonging, asserting themselves to belong or whatever, are the lucky parents and family. But others fall through the cracks.
So if you have a college educated parent who knows how to work the system, they're going to get a lot more benefits than the child who may be more at risk if parents have never had an opportunity to work through any kind of a system.
Bridge. Carrying that one step further, I live in Vancouver, British Columbia. Major fundraising in our schools is done through casinos, gambling, organized gambling.
Bingo?
No, it's real casino. Mm-hmm. And so who are we getting the money from? You know, those who know how, who are they milking to get that money?
The poor.
In my profession, we don't think of ourselves as very powerful, but we control an awful lot of lives in education. And in my field, which I often think of as very much off in the corner, I'm in ancient Near Eastern languages, which virtually nobody wants to know anything about. Very controlled access. You heard some of my complaints about how much it's going to cost to go to school. in the next several years. And we have given no consideration to the fact that people, we're just beginning to give consideration to the fact that people learn differently in higher education. That people who have as much to contribute and can learn as much, if you would slow down, and or not even slow down, just say it differently and show them differently, they could learn and then can turn around and contribute to the field. But what we've done is we've continued a system where everybody sits in a classroom and stares toward the front of the room in a class of 25 to 40 for hours and hours. And if the further you go, then finally you get some individual attention if you get up there in the graduate ranks. But even there, it's still a fairly narrow way of knowing how to know. Even knowing how to know how is pretty rigidly defined by those who've already got their degrees. And that, you're sitting in the presence of the only, as far as I know, the only African-American Bible professor in all of the Lutheran Church in the United States. That's how limited the access has been in our setting. Yes?
Speaking from the other end of the education system, I'm a kindergarten teacher, I have been, that our colleges and higher education are geared toward auditory learning. And if you are, and you, whether you're African American or white or whatever, are one of the people that learn through that method, therefore, that's prescribed way, and so you make it up the scale.
Mm-hmm.
But the person who is a tactile learner,
a visual
learner, becomes the auto mechanic, or does the trade jobs, which are not menial jobs, but on the social ladder.
Exactly.
Differently.
That's what I was trying to get out of the ways of learning. It's very frustrating for me to get up in front of a class and know that at any moment during the lecture, which is why I don't lecture. I basically ask questions and talk back to the class. At any moment in the lecture, only 25% of the people are paying attention. Even in the best of classes, the lecture method is that way. We've got to show people things. We've got to move people in the situations.
And what about, my husband brought home a video the other day about walking through the Bible and talking about biblical ignorance among people and so on, and I said, those are things we do in kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
They use their hands, and they made up the stories, and they moved their bodies, and they did things.
We learned as early childhood educators that children learn by doing. Piaget, you know, Piaget isn't dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something, for some reason we think just because we gain abstract thinking skills that we don't need to learn still by hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's critical. And I think also we're just learning about learning styles.
Yeah. And that learning styles in some cases are cultural.
Mm-hmm.
That the auditory style of learning is basically a Northern European style.
Mm-hmm.
Which has a certain efficacy, but when you talk to people from cultures who are storytelling cultures,
mm-hmm.
They hear the story and they abstract in a variety of ways that a Western thinker never would.
Mm-hmm.
A case in point is myself. When I started going to community college, the best mark grade I could get, and I was happy to get that, was a D. And it was in accounting and things like that. But I could just never seem to get it. Didn't seem, no matter what it was in. Maybe I got a C once in a while, but mostly D's, and I worked hard. But one day I walked into a classroom and this teacher was giving a class in history. I didn't like history, but I had to take it. But he walked in the door, like coming through an exit, he stepped in, and when he came in, he was telling his story. He walked in front of the room and told a story for the whole 45 minutes, walked out the door. That class I got an A, and for some reason that clicked in my mind, hey, I discovered something about myself, and after that I never got anything less than an A. Because I knew how to take any subject and make it into a story for me, except statistics.
comment, then I'm going to ask you to do some more discussion, and then we'll have to close.
Well, I was just going to comment in defense of what you were saying before. I don't see how you can do it any other way when teaching ancient languages. It's just in your particular area, because it's one of my interests, not Hebrew. But when you're talking about a dead language, I don't see any other way besides lecture and paradigm memorization to do it.
Yeah,
basically.
One of the things that I said is, where does it have to be that way? And there are some places where it has to be that way. But in ancient languages, we've said, go and learn the paradigms. Well, some people just sit down and look at them in a book. Some people write them out and write them out and write them out. Some people hear them, you put them on tapes. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're finally getting to the point where we realize that you do it a number of different ways, and people are going to learn it faster and better. Some people we go at different rates for different reasons, and we've assumed that the one who catches it the way that I caught it fastest is the brightest person. And we've got to admit that that's not the case, that there are other ways to do it. And there are other ways to learn, and there are other ways to teach it. One more minute. The question that I want us to we'll go over, and we'll break shalom again with the young kids if they're coming in here at 10, and with you if you've got commitments at 10. I want you to think about your communities and your churches and your congregations. What do they look like? Why do they look that way, and do they have to look that way? What I'm thinking about is the old saw. It's attributed in many cases to King that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. Certainly, we go to church ideally where we live, and that means that in many cases our church is going to look like our grocery store. A church is going to look like our office place. Well, is that what we want? And what can we do to change that? Whom have we invited to church lately? And maybe the question, what's exciting that's going on in for the creation of shalom in your church? What's going on in your congregation that says, let's make the world what God envisions it to be? Now, a whole lot of questions. You can take any one of those, but just turn around and talk to each other for a couple of minutes about those things. Or, if you really have to run out, take those questions with you and roll them over and talk with your pastor about them. If you're a pastor, talk with your council and your lay leadership about it. What is the vision that Scripture gives you for the way people are supposed to live in community with one another and with the environment? How much in the congregation is it a requirement that you know something that makes you some money so you can pay to live in the neighborhood, so you can be a member of that church, so you can belong?
Or you can read the big words in the hymn book. That is bothering me more and more. Very exclusive, our hymn book.
The vocabulary
is very exclusive. You have to have a church vocabulary, number one, and second of all, you have to be a good reader. Mm-hmm. Not everyone is a good reader. Some people can't read at all. Mm-hmm. Adults, I mean. Mm-hmm. They need to have choruses, they need to... There are other, it's not... It's a educator's... musician's hymn book.
Mm-hmm. Well, take a few minutes with that, and then we'll... For those of you who have to run, thank you for your time this week. It's been fun for me.